This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, March 22nd. I'm Philip Nice, and I just want to start off by giving a big thank you to you and to all our other listeners to thank you for tuning in to the Week in Review show every week. Maybe this is your first week, but many of you tune in every week to get the update on world news on Friday. And on Wednesday, many of you have been tuning in to our Wednesday show, which recently has been replays of some of our best episodes from the past few years now that Trumpet Hour has been on the air. And I also want to let you know, dear listener, that plans are in the works to make our weekly Trumpet KPCG offerings even better. We have a lot of sharp minds working on that and praying about that, and we just are excited to hopefully make the weekly update that we provide to you through KPCG even better. So we appreciate your interest and all that and all your feedback. Letters@thetrumpet.com, as always. We appreciate checking the inbox there and seeing something there from our listeners. So go ahead and write us, letters@thetrumpet.com. I'm here with our Philadelphia Trumpet writers. In the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
There in Edstone, England, Mihailo Zekic.
Good to be here.
Next to him at the studio there, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And joining us shortly will be Andrew Miller. And we will take it in that order with Jeremiah Jacques covering Asia. Then Mihailo will cover the Middle East. Mr. Palmer will update you on Europe. And Andrew Miller will bring us our update on Anglo-America. So again, this week we will start with the rundown of the top stories from Asia from Jeremiah Jacques.
First up is a quick update on Russia's war. We are on day 758 of the war. And over the last couple of days, the Russians have been just pummeling Ukrainian cities with missiles and drones. They are striking civilian targets, apartment buildings, power facilities, also another major dam, this time in Zaporizhia. And the big news is that huge numbers of Russia's missiles are now hitting their targets, unlike what we've seen up until this point in the war. So this suggests that Ukraine is getting very low on air defenses to protect the country. The attack last night was one of the largest in the war so far. It looks like around 88 missiles were fired and more than 60 Iranian-made drones. And the preliminary numbers suggest that Ukraine managed to shoot down only 37 of those missiles. 37 out of 88 is what it looks like. So Russia is wreaking real devastation with these terrorist attacks on civilians. And this is no surprise, really, because the United States stopped assisting Ukraine several months ago, even though a majority of Americans still support sending additional arms and military supplies. America's support ended despite that, and Ukraine is struggling a great deal now to defend against Russia's invasion. Next up is a story about Hong Kong. This is the former British colony that Britain handed over to China back in 1997, and China promised at that time that for at least 50 years, China would let Hong Kong's government and people have basically a high degree of autonomy in terms of economics and politics and even judicial autonomy. But China broke that promise. Even just a few years after the handover, the Chinese Communist Party started inserting itself into Hong Kong's affairs. And at times in the years that followed, the people of Hong Kong would stand up, they would protest, they would say, hey, you promised us 50 years of semi-autonomy. But China just kept on pushing, and then it was in 2020 that China succeeded, really, in asserting basically full control over Hong Kong. So we haven't said a whole lot about the situation since then because there's not much to say. But this week, Hong Kong's pro-Beijing lawmakers passed a new security law which expands the Chinese Communist Party's power and ability to be able to severely punish anything that it sees as dissent against the party. So it is being called the final nail in the coffin of Hong Kong's semi-autonomy. Hong Kong is now exactly like every other Chinese city, 100% under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. And then one other one here about China and Taiwan. Unlike Hong Kong, Taiwan is still free from Chinese control, but the Chinese are, of course, determined to end Taiwan's freedoms. They've been planning that for years, working toward a takeover of Taiwan. And a new Bloomberg report this week says China is building its military and nuclear arsenal at stunning speed. And it says, quote, all signs suggest that China will be able to follow through on its plan to invade Taiwan by 2027. Now, there was a related story this week with Taiwan saying for the first time that American troops are permanently stationed in Taiwan, including on a small Taiwanese island that's only about 1 mile from the Chinese mainland. So that was actually very big news, and I think it's encouraging to see America standing up more for our freedom-loving friends in Taiwan. But if current trends persist, it looks like this U.S. presence is likely too little too late. There was actually quite a bit of speculation in recent months that Russian President Vladimir Putin was waiting until he was reelected before he wanted to mobilize a lot more Russian soldiers for the war against Ukraine. Analysts knew that mobilizing more men, it's always politically unpopular, so he would want to wait until after he had clinched another term to do it, even though, of course, Russia's elections are shambolic. And it turned out that speculation was accurate. Russia's re-election victory was announced on Sunday. He won something like 105% of the vote. I think actually it was only 87%, but still very impressive. And then just days later, Putin's government announced what looks to be a significant expansion of Russia's military.
Putin has shown to the West and to his people that he is very careful in taking big decisions before these elections are over. It's a time of potential instability in the country. So usually straight after the election, when he has secured another 6 years, in the first months, he usually does a very unpopular decision that he has wanted to make for a long time, but wanted to wait after the election.
That was analyst Artur Rehi there, just talking about really the reason why Putin waited to make this announcement until after his sham election was complete. But the announcement said that Russia will be creating two new ground armies, which means more than 80,000 additional troops. They'll also be creating 30 additional military formations, and these will include 16 brigades and 14 divisions. So we don't know all the exact numbers for these brigades and these divisions, but if you add it all up based on existing formation sizes, it looks like a minimum of 240,000 new military personnel and possibly as many as 760,000 new personnel.
Соответственно, с решением Верховного Главнокомандующего продолжается поступательное развитие вооруженных сил России и повышение их боевых возможностей.
You hear Russia's Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, there announcing the details of this plan. Now, there is some skepticism about Russia's ability to make this happen in a timely manner, especially given the flight of many Russian men out of the country. Basically, every time a mobilization is announced, some of them flee. So this massive expansion, it might not happen overnight, but the announcement still shows the direction that Russia's moving in. And Russia's larger population does give it a significant numerical advantage over Ukraine. Russia has about 3.5 times the population of Ukraine, so that's a 3.5 times larger pool of men that it can draw from. But this announcement has implications even beyond Ukraine. This is apparently a plan to permanently expand the size of Russia's armed forces. The Russian leadership has hated to see the way they've had to leave some of their borders vulnerable to attack over the last 758 days since this full-scale war has been underway, because they've been focused so much on Ukraine. They've had to pull troops away from other areas. And so this is a plan that would let Russia essentially fight a major war in one location and still have enough troops left over to keep the country secure. So as I said, this won't happen overnight, but it does show the general direction that Russia's moving in, and that is in the direction of wars of aggression, wars of expansion, war that will let Russia take and get as much as it possibly can.
With what you mentioned about impacting other nations, I think it's interesting. We're starting to see more and more stories about Russia using some allied countries and surreptitiously sucking away some of their populations on the promise of, say, like jobs or that kind of thing, and putting them on the front lines. Recently, I just read a story that a lot of Indians are all of a sudden being coming to Russia for jobs and finding themselves on the front lines in Ukraine. Cuba had a problem like that as well. Now, like you were saying, Russia has a lot of men, but its supply of men isn't infinite. And some countries like Cuba, they've actually had some squabbles with Putin for doing this kind of thing. But if Russia's doubling down, if Russia needs more men, if Russia's already emptied their prisons, like the logical thing that pops into my head is like, are we going to start seeing North Korean mercenaries like fighting in Eastern Europe, or maybe some of these people from some of the Stan countries coming in? We're seeing Putin take more and more action, at least in my opinion, that you sort of get the sense, not necessarily out of desperation, but doing things that normally you just don't do because it rocks the boat so much. And if he has, again, a sham election, but if he has his power secure, if he's ready to double down on Ukraine, what else is he going to try and do? And who else is he going to try and bring into this conflict?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also think one thing we could expect to see is Putin begin to recruit more from Moscow and St. Petersburg. Those are the two wealthiest, you know, cities in Russia. So far, he has not touched the sons of the people who live there, because those are wealthy people. Those are the elite that he depends on the support of in order to stay in power. And so he's tried to not recruit from the two main population centers, the two main power centers in the country. But soon he may be forced to begin mobilizing some of the men from those areas. It sounds like a permanent expansion that'll be hundreds of thousands of additional troops. That's why I say this probably will take some time. It's not going to instantly materialize, but it is a plan to be able to field a far larger army indefinitely.
Well, you've talked many times before about a far larger army.
Yeah, that's really why I think this news is significant and why it's important for us to watch, because there is a Bible prophecy about an army that Russia will soon be leading that's larger by orders of magnitude than any army ever assembled in human history. Revelation 9, verse 16 tells us it'll be an army of 200 million troops that Russia will lead. And that's, of course, far larger than anything Russia could ever field on its own, since its whole population is not even 200 million. So we do know that China will be a major part of this future army, and also India and other Asian nations. But even still, when we see Russia planning to expand the size of its own military, adding thousands and thousands of men with these new brigades and divisions, it does bring to mind these Bible passages and about this 200 million man army. And it shows that we are getting nearer to the time of this Eastern Alliance.
Well, that is a stunningly specific thing for the book of Revelation to mention. I'm looking it up here. It talks about this army that is 200,000, and that is, as Jeremiah says, a 200 million man army. You can read more about that in Russia and China in Prophecy at thetrumpet.com/library. That's thetrumpet.com/library, and look for Russia and China in Prophecy. We'll move from the Asian region to the Middle East. Mihailo, you've been covering the Middle East, and what's caught your eye this week?
On Sunday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz visited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem to, in a show of solidarity, as well as to talk about what's going on in Gaza. We'll hear a little bit more about that later on in the program. And yesterday, Bloomberg had an interesting op-ed about the crisis going on in the Red Sea and the Houthi movement targeting ships there. According to people familiar with the matter, as anonymous sources are usually called, Russia and China have reached an agreement with the Houthis about their shipping through the Red Sea. The Houthis have apparently, according to the sources, agreed to leave Russian and Chinese ships alone, let their merchant traffic travel through the Red Sea up to the Suez Canal and the other way around as well, in exchange for Russia and China giving the Houthis protection in places like potentially the United Nations Security Council. We've heard a lot, of course, about Iran leveraging these trade gates, but Iran's not the only country interested in trade gates. China especially has tried to get control of the major trade arteries of the world. If the Bab el-Mandeb Strait ends up being one of them, I don't know. But at the same time, it's interesting to see China especially throw this kind of influence around while the world is talking about sea gates, as we term them, while the world is talking about maritime choke points that ties in with a prophecy in Isaiah 23 that Jeremiah covers often about China in an anti-American trade bloc. And also today, I'm going to do something I don't normally do and talk about something that hasn't happened yet. The United States is about to introduce a resolution in the United Nations Security Council calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. This one is a bit stronger worded than some of the other initiatives the U.S. has tried to put through. This one specifically calls for an immediate ceasefire and has nothing to say directly about releasing hostages. At this point, I don't want to give too much comment on it until the vote actually happens. So I'll hopefully have something for you on that next week, but it should happen just a few hours after the time of recording. So expect a lot of changes coming from New York and the UN in the coming hours.
I'm curious how much you think the UN ruling will change things, given... Like, I know the Russian ambassador says, okay, it says that it's imperative that this happens. I think what the Russian ambassador says, well, if it's imperative that you give me $100, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will give me $100 or that there are any consequences if you don't give me $100.
Well, I mean, the UNSC has the authority to enforce whatever it wants to enforce, however enforceable it thinks it is. So even if nothing happens from this, it'd be interesting to see who uses this as an excuse within the UN to say, well, we passed it, Israel didn't listen, we have to do something.
Right, I guess that's my question. So this is probably more laying the groundwork to further persecution of Israel from the United Nations, and even indicating that the United States will support that persecution of Israel at the United Nations, rather than there being immediate consequences tonight.
Exactly. And the other thing is, I'm just curious to see exactly how everybody votes. Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting too much, but considering everything we've been talking about the Europeans and how they've sort of looked like Israel's best friend, part of me, it's a little bit unlikely at this point, part of me is wondering if maybe France will all of a sudden step in with a veto or something to make itself look like the good guy. I wouldn't put it past Emmanuel Macron. He's pretty good, I'd say, as far as world leaders go, at navigating the art of diplomacy and still making your country relevant. So, but again, we'll find out in a few hours either way. I'm going to shift gears a little bit now and take you from what most people consider the heartland of the Middle East, Israel and the area around there, and take you to a more peripheral region, but I wouldn't say unimportant region, and that is West Africa. We've talked a lot before on this program about what's going on in the West African country of Niger, or depending on how you pronounce it, Niger, this country that's just below the Sahara Desert in this region we call the Sahel. It's still part of the greater Muslim world, still struggles with problems like Islamic extremism, which is why I consider it to be part of the Middle East. There was a coup that happened there last year that evicted its pro-Western government. And speaking of France, France used to have a lot of peacekeepers out there, if memory serves me right, about 1,600 or something like that. And the new junta that came in basically wanted the French out. They left by the end of last year. But that's not the end of the story. There's a lot more going on there than meets the eye. The U.S., for its part, still has several hundred soldiers in Niger. They've been cozying up to the new regime a little bit, and the new government has let them stick around. But looks like that is changing for a very important reason. On Sunday, the Wall Street Journal published an exclusive citing sources within Niger as well as U.S. officials claiming that the Nigerian government was involved in a deal with Iran, of all countries, on the other extreme of my region, but again, no less important. And the specific deal involved Niger's uranium supplies. A lot of people don't realize this. When people talk about the Middle East and Africa, some of these places, often you'll hear about like oil, or as I mentioned in the rundown, like trade choke points, that kind of thing, as like the big importance of this region. Niger is the seventh biggest uranium producer in the world. In 2022, Niger recorded over almost 2,500 tons of uranium produced just in that year alone. Until the coup happened, it's still up in the air whether this will continue, but Niger supplied almost a quarter of the EU's entire uranium imports. That's a lot of uranium. And of course, what do you do with uranium? You could either use it to make nuclear energy, or you could use it to make nuclear bombs. And who's the big country right now that wants to make a nuclear bomb? Iran. For their part, that same year, Iran produced an estimated 24 tons of uranium. It's on the opposite end of the spectrum, even on that production. We talk a lot on this program about how much Iran is getting close to a nuclear bomb. Iran, compared to some other countries, doesn't actually have that much uranium. Most people suspect what they've been using is their local supplies. They don't have that much. If you times that by 100 and Iran gets this kind of access to Niger's uranium, their nuclear program is already so far ahead. What is this going to mean? Yes, again, they're on the opposite sides of the Middle East, but Iran has a history of using very unconventional and what to many countries would be too long supply lines and using them for good purpose, like supplying Gaza, for example. How did they supply Hamas with all these weapons? By sailing their smugglers through the Red Sea onto the Sinai Peninsula. That's still a long way. Iran has many, many levels of influence and extends their tentacles all over the place in Africa. They sponsored jihadi groups there before. Them getting this kind of uranium to all the way back to Iran surreptitiously is not that far-fetched. Again, I mentioned the U.S. had a bit of a spat with this. They apparently been tracing, found out about this all the way back in January. And apparently there is a preliminary agreement between Iran and Niger signed. It hasn't been officially established yet. But because of that spat, Niger is starting to get a little too unfriendly with the U.S. troops.
The U.S. presence on the territory of the Republic of Niger is illegal and violates all the constitutional and democratic rules which would require the sovereign people, in particular through its elected representatives, to be consulted on the installation of a foreign army on its territory.
This was in response to what the United States is pressuring Niger to do, which is sort of back off from Iran, back off from Russia. That's another player that wants to send in mercenaries over there. And they basically said, yeah, if you're going to start telling us what to do, we don't want your soldiers here anymore. Like, you could get out. As the spokesman said, they're illegal. Now, we'll see what exactly the U.S. does. But if they withdraw with this knowledge in hindsight, with the knowledge that they knew about this before we did, this will basically be them giving one of the biggest sources of uranium in the world to Iran on a silver platter. We know they want the bomb. We know they're close to getting a bomb. At this point, it's not a bomb that we have to worry about anymore. They could get a whole arsenal. And the fact that they're going all the way to this country in Africa to try and ensure it shows how desperate they want it.
I think the other thing to think about as well is Europe's reaction that, I mean, Niger used to be the key supply for France's uranium industry. So, you know, from their perspective, oil from Russia is being cut off, oil from the Red Sea is being restricted, uranium is being cut off. North Africa has been a mess for years. Europe had a strategy for dealing with that, and that was primarily France making deals with its ex-colonial countries and trying to create a regional coalition to fight off radical Islam. And that has utterly, utterly failed with governments like Niger and Mali and the undergoing coups and having radically anti-French governments come to power. So this whole area is becoming a mess for Europe on so many different levels. You know, they're worried about Iran getting all of these bombs. They're losing their energy security. They want to build pipelines that come through Niger and elsewhere that bring gas from Nigeria up to Algeria and across to it. Like, so Europe needs to radically rethink its approach to this area too. So this is just one more bit of pressure making Europeans think, well, maybe we need to do a lot more to stabilize this region, because if we don't, the chaos is coming our way.
That's right. And what are you looking for, Mihailo, specifically with this particular country that we don't talk about too often, but we do talk about it?
Well, I'm glad Mr. Palmer mentioned Europe, because that involves what I'm looking for. There's actually two things I'm looking for, or at least we're watching for in this part of the world, that Niger could play a part in. The Bible prophecy that we go to for this is in Daniel 11, verses 40 to 43, which, as we talk on this program, often talks about an end-time king of the north and a king of the south, or two power blocks clashing with each other. You can read the rest of the prophecy. It leads into a World War III. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has identified the King of the North as a united European bloc and the King of the South as a radical Islamist bloc led by Iran. Now, in that passage, it talks about some other countries that fall to the King of the North, and by deduction, we can figure out who's going to be allied with Iran, because the implication is they fall at the same time, but they're not the king, they're subordinate. And it mentions countries like Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, all in Africa. North Africa and West Africa have been really susceptible to Islamist insurgencies in places like Niger, in places like Mali, in some of these other countries. And Iran's trying to get their links in. They're always trying to export their Islamic revolution. We are expecting a bigger Iranian presence. And we're also expecting Europe to take note of that. And the key word there in verse 40 is whirlwind. And how that's going to be the King of the North's attack. And how does a whirlwind attack from all sides? And which implies that Europe is also going to have a big presence in North Africa too. And we're seeing countries like this get more and more attention from both these powers. Not that long ago, like the big players that people were looking at who's going to get involved are the United States or Russia, or well, France obviously had a stake in it, but nobody was talking so much about Iran becoming king in the region. And nobody was certainly talking about Europe getting consternated that they want to double down on their presence. And now we're starting to see people talk about that. Regarding nuclear bombs, specifically, the prophecy says that Iran would push or provoke, unnecessarily hurt Europe. A nuclear bomb's a good way of doing that. And even with this particular case, I mean, again, the fact that it used to supply Europe's uranium, and now Iran may actually steal it for itself to build a nuclear bomb and cause so much chaos in the world, that's in itself is a pretty big provocation. What exactly the Europeans are thinking about it. Again, France's energy industry still has some influence in Niger. It's not like they've been completely kicked out, so we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But still, you could totally see a kind of clash, just like as Daniel described, happening in a microcosm within this small country and also within North Africa and the Middle East as a whole.
So Niger and what happens there certainly worth watching and worth dwelling on this week, and worth an article that Milo has written called Why Niger is a Catastrophe for the World. Why Niger is a Catastrophe for the World. And right, as Mr. Palmer mentioned, what you certainly see in this continent, Africa, is a clear theater of strategic struggle and potential conflict between this king of the South, radical Islam led by Iran, and this king of the North, which is Europe. So you can definitely see that struggle becoming more and more in earnest and more and more clear. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review on KPCG 101.3 here in Edmond, Oklahoma. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to KPCG 101.3 and Trumpet Hour Week in Review. I'm your host, Philip Nice, and the next region we're going to cover, after having covered Asia with Jeremiah Jacques and the Middle East with Mihailo Zekic, is Europe, and that'll be from Richard Palmer.
France has gone with Europe's favorite fundraising tactic, and that is fining an American tech giant. They fined Google €250 million. It works out about $271 million over their AI. It makes Google the first company to be fined by a European regulator for artificial intelligence. It's for their use of copyrighted training data, which... this is a contentious issue, and I think those that criticize AI companies for saying that they're using training data without fairly compensate, like if you put real artwork into an AI model and train it to do art, the artist's creativity is in a very real sense going into what this AI produces. And I think those that say, well, they need to be compensated, yeah, that sounds only fair to me. However, the other important angle to this, I think, is Europe's desire to dominate the AI market. And they have crafted their rules in such a way that they're going to trip up US companies much more than I think the one French kind of major AI company that is out there. So, yeah, I think I don't necessarily feel super sorry for Google, And there's probably a case here, but we can't overlook that this is the EU wants to dominate this new space, and that's a part of that story. Talking of dominating a new space, Romania broke ground on what's going to be NATO's largest base in Europe. It's a new air base, and it is in Romania. So NATO setting up now more in Eastern Europe after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And it's another sign of Europe militarizing. They're building this base. There are signs of a break with the United States coming. All is not well within NATO. But they're building this base. Bases can be used by anyone. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it ends up being German troops stationed on this Romanian base once it's finally built.
Well, the United States has been known to be generous with its bases that it leaves behind. You could see another power besides U.S. dominated NATO as taking control of that. And as far as the artificial intelligence or these advanced technologies that we are calling artificial intelligence, it's such a fast moving thing and it's hard to understand. But I do appreciate you and Trump editor in chief Gerald Fleury also saying watch for Europe to use this as a tool. Here are the things to watch when it comes to artificial intelligence. Would you say that's the main thing you're watching in just the artificial intelligence high technology field? Is that kind of the main thing that we're looking to come out of this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think development of military applications, things like that. I think the way that there was a fascinating article, I can't remember who had it now, maybe it was Politico or someone like that, about how Ukraine is becoming the first AI war. Mm. And you've got companies like Palantir that are very heavily invested in monitoring what's going on in that war as they just kind of look at how these tools could be developed. I think there's lots of interesting things to look at with artificial intelligence, but that's probably the main one. I guess also I'm just personally interested in any progress towards what we used to call artificial intelligence. I think now we've changed that, redefined that to be a generalized artificial intelligence, which is an artificial intelligence that is actually intelligent and can start asking questions about its own processes and, you know, is not just following a recipe the way that all of these ones are.
Right. It's an interesting space to watch and to watch Europe's use of it specifically, as you mentioned there. What would you say is the main story for Europe this week?
So I'd like to talk about Olaf Scholz, his trip to Israel, and I think just in particular, look at the contrast with the United States. And this is one of the most important things to be watching from what is coming out in Israel and the aftermath of the October 7th attack. So it's really worth keeping a close eye on this, where Israel is coming under a lot of pressure right now. For people want them to go easy on the Palestinians, that there's all of this, you know, that too many people are dying, et cetera, et cetera. They completely ignore the fact that this conflict could stop tomorrow if Hamas would let go the hostages.
Right.
That they've got, what is it, over 100 innocent people, innocent civilians, for the most part. They've still got them hostage. They're still, like, if this was the United States, it would be utterly unthinkable for the United States to stop this conflict while they're still American citizens in enemy custody with no plans or hope for their release. It is insane. Like, it is completely unhinged that people are trying to get Israel to stop fighting when they've got prisoners that they need freed. And it's horrific what Hamas is doing. And I just can't believe that we've forgotten so quickly what happened on October 7th. I think there's very much as well just a misguided Bible element here, where you do have even religious leaders calling for saying, well, we need to be merciful. And it's a fundamental misapplication of the Bible that is having real impact on international news. And just in one of my classes earlier today, we were talking about, you look at, I think it's in 1 Kings chapter 20, and God severely corrects a king of Israel because he makes peace too quickly with his enemy. And his enemy comes to him in sackcloth and kind of humbles himself and he lets him go. And God says, you should not have done that. I'm going to punish you severely because you did that. And that's the same God the God of the Old Testament is Jesus Christ, the same God that died for mankind, the same God that is love. But sometimes love is utterly defeating an evil power rather than letting them remain in place so that the problems continue. So anyway, you've got this insane push against Israel to compromise with Hamas, even though they've still got hostages. And in this, Germany is not innocent. They are pushing for this. But compared to the United States, they're looking like the better partner for Israel. So Olaf Scholz was in Israel on Sunday, and you've got, you know, last week Chuck Schumer getting up there and basically saying, we want Netanyahu gone. You've got leaked reports in the Jerusalem Post from saying the Biden administration is looking for ways to get rid of Netanyahu. There was someone else who said, well, I'm frequently contacted by the Biden administration for advice on Israeli politics. They've been telling me, how do we get rid of Netanyahu? Like, it's almost open, especially with Chuck Schumer's comments that America wants regime change. And Olaf Scholz was there sitting next to Benjamin Netanyahu hosting a joint press conference. So, yeah, he did say that the Palestinian death toll, he said it was extremely high and many would argue much too high. And Germany is participating in this raining down supplies and relief for those in Gaza, which, again, this is insane. Like, the idea that in 1944 we would be dropping relief supplies on Germany, Nazi Germany, instead of prosecuting the war with everything that we have available. Like, 1917, 1944, we were trying to starve the Germans into submission. Why is it wrong for Israel to do the same thing now? It's a standard that has never been applied to history in history, and a standard we'd never applied to ourselves. But anyway, they're doing this. But compared to the United States, they are looking more and more like the more reliable option. And another aspect of this is some just insane news that's come out towards the end of this week in what the United States is doing. So Israel's Channel 14 News is reported about this Biden administration push to build a pier off the coast of Gaza. You may have heard about this. This is to help them get in aid to the Palestinians more easily. Well, according to Channel 14, the U.S. has asked Qatar to build and manage this pier. So Qatar, like the protectors and sponsors of Hamas, America has said, we want you to build this pier. Qatar have turned around and asked Al-Hissi, which is a company controlled by Hamas, to be the ones that actually build it. So now you're looking at, like, not just America giving aid to Hamas, but America having Hamas build the infrastructure for importing more things into Gaza. Like, this is a major boost in power for Hamas if they then control, like, the port infrastructure. They're directly undermining Israel's goal of getting Hamas out of Gaza. The head of the Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, he said the U.S. has flipped sides from Israel to Qatar. That's what they're doing here. Melanie Phillips wrote, America could end this war tomorrow by telling the Qataris that unless they instruct Hamas to surrender and release the hostages, Qatar will forfeit its preferential treatment by the United States and will henceforth be treated instead as an international pariah. So America, if they really cared about civilian casualties, could finish this now. The Biden administration could be done with this. Said instead, America is feeding Israel into the Qatari Jews. She says America's action is so preposterous it's hard to believe. Yet in any event, the Biden administration has already pivoted from supporting the destruction of Hamas to working for its ultimate victory. So you've got a not entirely reliable ally in the form of Germany and Olaf Scholz, but you've got an ally that switched to being an enemy with the United States in many ways. And so you can definitely see how this is going to pave the way for Israel relying more on Germany.
Absolutely. And that's something we've been looking for a while and wondering, how would that happen? What would be the steps leading up to that? What would that look like? We're getting a pretty good idea of what that is. Why is it that we've been watching for that particular relationship? And along the way, every year, when there's anything that happens, any address in the Knesset from a German chancellor, for example, anything like that, we've jumped all over it. And even this, you know, Olaf Scholz makes a visit. He makes a lot of visits, but this one is important. And why is it that we really focus in on it?
This is an absolutely key Bible prophecy. We heard already from Simon about Daniel chapter 11. And this, it gives us a countdown of events, really, to the return of Jesus Christ. And Germany making this partnership with Israel is kind of a key part to that countdown. And you look at the book of Daniel and you start being able to, at some point, count days towards this event happening. And it gives us that. And Israel making a peace deal with Germany is tied into when you start counting those days. Like, it's that, it's almost part of the stopwatch or the trigger mechanism for this countdown. So this is something just new. A lot of Daniel 11, there's events there that happened anciently that have already been fulfilled. But Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to 45 describe this clash that we've heard about between the king of the north and the king of the south. But Israel plays a key role in that clash. and it describes the King of the North entering into the Holy Land in this clash. And the way that it describes entering into is not, it doesn't use the word invade, it doesn't use conquer, it uses a word that's associated with peaceful entry. The implication being they're invited in. And the Bible, like Mr. Armstrong talked about, is a jigsaw puzzle. You start fitting in pieces of this puzzle from other scriptures, and it shows that Israel trusts Germany for its defense. They invite German soldiers in. As the Middle East kind of erupts in chaos, they invite German and European soldiers in to come and help protect them. These soldiers ultimately betray and turn against Israel and take Jerusalem for themselves. And this is, we have a whole booklet called Watch Jerusalem because of the role that Jerusalem plays in end time events. This is absolutely a key moment, as I said, but then it starts this countdown. I mean, it plays a major role in World War III happening, but it's a major role on the countdown for the return of Jesus Christ and all of this wonderful hope that we're looking for as well. And so it's really because of that hope that we focus on this news event so much. And we do have that article, As You Watch Gaza, Watch Germany. It was the front cover of our January 2024 Trumpet print edition, just talking about this role that Germany will increasingly play as Israel's new best friend.
As some of those future events you're describing there seem hard to imagine, but if you can, go back to, 10 years ago and remember what it would have been like to imagine United States funding the side that's shooting the rockets onto the civilians and the civilians trying to defend themselves, airdropping supplies into Gaza, building a port, turning it over to Hamas immediately after they murdered men, women, and children in the streets with automatic weapons on October 7th. I mean, just understand what is literally unfolding and how crazy it is, and notice Germany's role in it, and notice the fact that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, in the immediate aftermath where everyone was just horrified by Hamas as all the details were coming in, he said, as you watch Gaza, watch Germany. So some very specific things to watch, and they are bearing out over time. They are bearing out. So As You Watch Gaza, Watch Germany was the title of the article by Mr. Fleury. And also the booklet, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, is available there on thetrumpet.com as well. That's The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem. We move on now to the Anglo-America region. Andrew Miller has joined us. Andrew, what's been happening in the English-speaking nations?
Yeah, Canada will no longer be allowing arms sales to Israel after a parliamentary motion in favor of a Canadian plan to work towards the establishment of a state of Palestine. Barack Obama mysteriously dropped by number 10 Downing Street for a meeting with United Kingdom Prime Minister Rishi Sunak this week. And the Guttmacher Institute published a report on March 19th showing that an estimated 1 million abortions have occurred in the United States following the overturn of Roe v. Wade. So that's actually a 10% increase in abortions since Roe v. Wade was overturned.
All right. That's some dire news.
And can I just point out one thing quickly?
Yes.
You know who Canada will sell arms to?
Who's that?
Qatar.
Qatar. Okay. This upside down world of ours, the budget appears to be upside down as well.
Yeah, the budget's been upside down for a long time. Here at the Philadelphia Trumpet, we've been warning that the United States has been hurling towards bankruptcy since basically our first few issues in the early 1990s. I could actually sympathize with some of our listeners who feel like tuning out this message, because it definitely is like a slow motion train wreck. You never know exactly when it's going to crash. But we did just get another report this week, a 30-year outlook from the budget office, which is completely shocking. They predicted that 30 years from now, in the year 2054, the debt held by the public will have ballooned up to 166% of GDP. And that actually doesn't count intergovernmental debt, like the debt we've looted from our own Social Security fund. So if you include that in there, the national debt would be roughly double gross domestic product. which is shocking because right now, actually, we spend about 2% of our gross domestic product just on interest in the national debt. We actually spend more in interest on the national debt than we spend on defense, which we've pointed out before is a point where many nations start losing their overseas influence because you're pulling back the money you're spending defending sea gates to redirect that towards interest payments on the national debt. But according to this 30-year outlook, by the year 2054, that's set to more than double. Actually, I think it's supposed to go all the way up to 6.3% of gross domestic product. And by way of comparison, that outlook says that we're only going to be collecting about 18% of gross domestic product in taxes, which means that like one-third of tax dollars collected will go towards the national debt. And the other two-thirds is going to be Social Security and Medicare. So the military, the roads, the president's salary, everybody's salary, like the entire cost of running the government will be on borrowed money because 100% of your tax revenue, all your tax revenue is going to be going towards interest on the national debt, Social Security, and Medicare, just three things, which is really shocking, even sinful, because you're robbing from future generations. That's what really shocked me with this, is like even comparing it to a personal family finance standpoint. Isaac here knows that I'm a fan of the financial advisor, Dave Ramsey, one of the better financial advisors in America. He always says that financial success, whether you're talking about people or nations, is 20% head knowledge and 80% behavior. And there's only five behaviors. Have a written budget, live on less than you make, get out of debt, save money, and be generous with your wealth once you have it. On the personal level, most people who struggle with credit card debt and things like that have a breakdown on behavior one. They don't have a written budget and they have no clue where their money goes. They need to actually start keeping track of your finances. Shockingly, that is not the United States' problem. They do have a written budget and they know exactly where their money going. And they have a well laid out 30-year plan towards the end of Western civilization. So it's not a fact that it's like, oh, we don't know what we're spending on. So no, we know what we're spending it on. And we know exactly how much of our money is going to be going towards interest 30 years from now. And we know that you can't spend a third of your income on interest payments. I mean, banks stop lending people money when their debt-to-income ratio hits 36%. And right. America fully plans to hit that in 2054, if not sooner, if interest rates goes up. So they know this is unsustainable, but they still don't do anything about it. And there's no plan to do anything about it. It's like, that's why you're saying that's sinful. It's not just carelessness, which is also sinful, but actual, like, evil. And the fact that your attitude really is, like, most Congress people are in their 60s or 70s, like, yeah, I'll be dead in 30 years. Let my grandkids deal with it.
I wanted to mention some chronology looking back about the debt that is also very sobering, and that is that it was in 1981 that America's national debt crossed the $1 trillion mark. $1 trillion. That was right after our bicentennial, you know, 1976. So it took us more than 200 years as a nation to accrue that first trillion of national debt. And that was unprecedented. It was staggering. It was jolting enough to really force a national conversation about the fiscal health of America. Ronald Reagan was president at the time, and he said, if we as a nation needed a warning, let that be it. But of course, we didn't heed that warning. It took us only about 4 years to double that number, to hit our second trillion. That was 1985. And then about 5 years to get to three. By the time you get to the 2000s, we were adding roughly half a trillion per year. Then after the Great Recession, that jumps to about $1 trillion per year, for many of those years at least. So we're just plunging in the hole faster and faster. And of course, now we're at a point where since the pandemic, we're accruing $1 trillion of additional debt almost every 100 days. So it's just stunning that it took us 200 years to pile up the first trillion, and now it's happening almost every quarter.
It's like you said, Andrew, managed decline. People are saying American leaders are entering managed decline. They're like, we are declining. We're not going to fight it. We're just going to manage it. And you see that number by number, year by year, dollar by dollar in the stats that you're talking about. And it just shows, like you're saying there, Jeremiah, I mean, all this affluence and power, financial power, economic power that the United States has had. And because of our actions, because of our behaviors, like you said, Andrew, the strength is spent in vain. The military bases are spent in vain. The money, the political efforts, the diplomacy, the alliances are, in some cases, our money and our honor is fighting itself, like in Gaza. We're actually fighting ourselves. It's almost as if there's a cause that you really express well, I thought, Andrew. It's almost as if there's a powerful cause, right? Not just this, you know, side issue of morality, or it's almost as if there's such a thing as cause and effect, as if there are principles. It's almost as if there are laws of human life, which even many of the religions, even many of the churches won't tell you that there are laws in effect of human life. It's almost as if there is such a thing as sin, like you said, Andrew, doing wrong things, breaking the laws of nature and of nature's God. And you see that in a very black and white way with that story that you brought us there. And you referred in the notes you provided to me to the trend, why the trumpet watches America's economic collapse. Like you said, watching a train wreck in slow motion. That's at thetrumpet.com/trends, why the trumpet watches America's economic collapse. And that is all the time we have for this week's Week in Review here on Trumpet Hour. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate you emailing us your thoughts at letters@thetrumpet.com. And we are, as I said, working and meeting and discussing and test running and evaluating and finally deciding how to get your news to you each week and Bible prophecy through KPCG and The Trumpet. So please keep that in mind. We thank our panel, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. Thank you, Parker Campbell and Isaac Lorenz, both here in the room with us doing engineering and production. But thank you, most of all, for listening to The Week in Review here on Trumpet Hour. We look forward to being back with you next week.